Hi, everybody. My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Polly.
By God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977, and for that, I am eternally grateful. And I have faith. I have a home group, and that's a third legacy group in Bellingham, Washington, and we meet at 7 o'clock on Monday night. And if you're ever in Bellingham, please give us a call, and I'll take you to a meeting. And Dave and I are in the phone book. It's amazing when you get sober, you can be in the phone book. So just give us a call, and I'll take you to a meeting. And I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. I can just tell you that I am just overwhelmed that I am a part of this weekend. It's just, I look around and I see these heroes and I'm just like, you know, I don't know how you feel about you, but I'm just like, what am I doing here? And I am so honored to be here. I have been with all these people that are on this program this weekend at some point, but I've never been on a program with all of them at once. And I just feel so honored And I just want to let you know that, and I'm just so grateful that I get to be with Franny, and I've known Franny. Franny comes down from my area, and I know Franny in a lot of reasons, in other ways too, because I happen to sponsor her daughter-in-law. So you know, you get. I love Franny, and I love Linda and Scott, and I was so excited to hear their workshop. And I tell you what I love, because I'm one of these people that I am so in love with my husband. I am one of these ooey gooey people that is just so crazy about their guy. And Dave and I have been two alcoholics. Now this is what an order. I can't go through with it. We're two alcoholics hooked up together, and we've been married 27 years. You know, wow. Talk about great events will come to pass. And I just think they're so cute, the way they look at each other and the way they feel about each other. And, you know, and I'm with you, Scott. Old people do have a good time being in love. And it's fabulous. So it's, I love that. And one of my heroes is Clancy. And last night, I don't remember when I've ever heard Clancy better. It's just, it seems like, and my admiration for him and the service that he does in Alcoholics Anonymous and how it's untiring, and he just keeps on going. And I loved sitting next to Sandy last night, because he was just, he said, he has made me happy for 40 years. And I just thought, you know, that's it. That's what that, and he's made me happy for 31 years. And being able to continue to hear him share, because he continues to do what he does. And it's going to be wonderful to be with Sandy and Michael and Dick. And I love all these people. And I just feel like, I told Sandy I was way out of my league, and he assures me that I'm not, but that's, you know, we are all kind to each other. So anyway, I'm going to talk on the fourth step, and what I'm going to talk on is fear and sex. And I loved listening to Scott do his resentment list. His resentment inventory. And you know, we all kind of do things a little bit different. And I think that's fabulous, because let me tell you something. I have no qualifications to be up here telling you about how I do this program other than that I've done it and that I have helped other people do it. And that's the only qualification. I haven't been to speech school or anything like that. I'm the kid in school that stood up to do a book report and couldn't even do it because I was so scared. I just had to go home because I was sick. So I have no qualifications other than that I have done the work, and I continue to do what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do. And that's that. I trust God, clean house, and help others. And it's really simple. And I'm a real Dr. Bob lover. And I love Bill and Bob. But I always have kind of seen myself on kind of doing things a lot like Dr. Bob did it. And I hang out with a lot of people from Ohio, so I do a lot of stuff like Back to the 40s and all of the stuff that we learned early on. So it's kind of where, that's kind of where I'm coming from. So the qualifications that I have to do this is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsorship, meetings, and lots of prayers. Lots and lots of prayers. And I love what my husband says, that God does not call the qualified. He qualifies the called. So you're called. We're here in this room. And what we've come here to do is to trust God, clean house, and help others. And I want to read two things from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I believe is why we do this work. Because I'm going to tell you right now, I can contemplate, I can do inventory, I can do all that stuff till I am absolutely blue in the face, till I can't pick up another pencil, till I can't write again. But if I do not take this and work with others, I will not stay sober. Because what I have to do is be of service and work with others. That's my job. That's why I'm sober, is so that I can work with others. That's what we're here to do. And I'd just like to read this on, I love Earl Treat. I happen to have my son lives in the Chicago area, so they're really big on Earl Treat. And he has his story in here. He sold himself short. And you know something, guys? I'm not doing what Scott said, because this is a third edition Big Book, and I just really don't want to write up another one. You know, so I'm really lazy, so I'm still in my third edition. So anyway, on page 291 in his story, he said, "The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, a Wednesday, and Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me down to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. The steps were, 1, complete deflation. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power. 3, moral inventory. 4, confession. 5, restitution. 6, continued work with other alcoholics." And a lot of this stuff we read about when Bill wrote the Big Book, he just wanted more steps. So we have 12, and they just kind of broke and made a couple of them, some of these steps, into 2. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps at the moral inventory. He brought up some of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. We went over these at great length, and then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. This picture is still vivid. If I live to be 100, it will always stand out in my mind. It was very impressive, and I wish that every AA could have the benefit of this type of sponsorship today. One of the things that I like to say is that I got sober in Texas, and one of the things we did is we did the steps, we did them in quick. One of the things that I was told is this is a textbook, and that what we want to do is get through the steps and then study this book for a lifetime. And so that's the way I take people through the steps. Now, I don't do it in 3 or 4 hours. I may do a 4-step inventory in 3 or 4 hours, but I've never been able to do the whole thing like Bob does. But I do take many people, come to my home over a weekend, and I take many women through the steps in a weekend. So I know that that can be done, and that's just me. I don't know that everybody agrees with that, but I think that's one thing that's wonderful about Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just like what Scott says, and I feel the same way. If your sponsor tells you to do it however he or she tells you to do it, I agree with them. Because one of the things that I know is this is a God's deal. It's a God deal. And whatever leads you to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and whatever leads you to the person you ask to sponsor you, that's a God deal. And I can tell you right now, I just don't want to get in God's way. I've tried that long enough, and I can guarantee it doesn't work. Okay, the other thing I want to read you is in Bill's story. And this is what it's all about. And I think this sums it up as to why we do this work. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was an imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. How appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And I just want to kind of share something that's a story that I love. And I was sponsoring a girl in Southern California. She now has another sponsor after I moved from Southern California. But she had come up to me, and we'd done her inventory, and we had done some steps. And, you know, she just wasn't feeling as good as she thought she ought to feel. And she came up to me, and she says, "Well, I think I need to do another inventory because I'm not feeling too good." I said, "You do not need to write one more thing about yourself. What you need to do is you need to go work with others." And what happened as a result of that is she joined H&I, found a gorgeous guy there, fell in love, and had a couple of kids and still sober because she got into service. Now, I'm not going to tell you that you're going to find the man of your dreams or the woman of your dreams if you go, you know, join H&I, but I can guarantee you that if you want to feel better, then go work with others. So the reason that we do this work is so that we can work with others. And there was an old man in Long Beach that a bunch of us kind of followed around. And there isn't a day that goes by today that I still don't think about Frank Honeycutt. Frank Honeycutt was the finest man I have ever known. And I was talking one day with somebody, and we were discussing Frank, and this was just a few months ago. And she said, and I agreed, and she says, "You know, Frank Honeycutt was somebody I knew that no one ever said anything bad about." And I don't know, but I mean, wow. And Frank was the finest man I've ever known. And I'm going to tell you a couple little stories about him. One of them is Frank was very loving. And if you walked up to Frank and you know, he was very patient. If you had some big deal to talk about, he would listen to you. And then he would just gently put his arms around you, and he would say, "You know something, chicken?" And if he could never remember people's names. So if you were a girl, he called you chicken. And if you were a boy, he called you partner. And so he would just put his arms around you, and he'd say, "You know something, chicken? If you'll just go help somebody, you'll feel better." And then I have this friend in Australia. And she used to go over every year to, well, she still does, but when Frank was alive, she knew that Frank would be at the Hawaii Convention. Every year, Frank would be at the Hawaii Convention. She could count on that. So here she goes, and she flies from Australia, but she needs to talk to Frank Honeycutt because he's going to give her the answer. And so anyway, she lays out this whole thing to Frank, and he says, "Well, sweetheart, what you need to do is you just need to go help somebody." And she says, "Well, wait a minute. Maybe you didn't hear all of just what I had to say." But Frank was a gentleman, and he very patiently listened to her tell it again. And when she finished, he lovingly said to her, "You know something, sweetheart? You'll just feel a lot better if you'll go help somebody." So Doreen says that it cost her $3,000 to find out that the message in Alcoholics Anonymous is do the steps and go help somebody. That's how it all works. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about fear. And what I want to do is get to where I want to go with the fear. And what happens is that fear, when we, if you look in the book at the diagram, fear is all, they have fear bracketed behind everything that affects my self-esteem, my security, my ambition, my personal and sex relationships, my pocketbook. It all has to do with fear. Now, I am a person that has been driven by 100 forms of fear. Now, I grew up and I was never abused myself, but I was parented by parents who were abused. And one of the things that I love about the inventory is I have taken this from Michael, because Michael says, and I do this with my women today, is before I tell you my story, let me tell you my parents' story. And my parents' story was that they came from abused, they were abused children. My mother especially was severely abused. Her mother died at birth, and she was raised by a stepmother, and it was the whole, you know, like Cinderella story, except she didn't find the prince. And so it was, what happened was, is that I never could understand, because I loved what Scott said. Scott said he went to the 28-day program and then you stayed for 6 weeks or how. That was me. That's what happened to me. I was court committed to treatment, and they did that in Fort Worth, Texas in 1977. And I think that Clancy was also court committed, and so was I. And at any rate, I couldn't get out of this treatment center till they thought I was ready. And that was 6 weeks after I entered it. So, at any rate, I was, where was I going with that story? I can't even remember now. But anyway, oh, my parents were abused. Okay. And we were sitting in this, thank you. We were sitting, you know how, I think it's still today the same way it was when I got sober. And that is, you sit in group and you talk about your feelings and all the things that happened to you as a kid and all of that stuff. And I would look at these people sitting in these groups, and I could understand why they were an alcoholic. I mean, I can see if I was listening to these awful things that happened to little boys and girls. And those things hadn't happened to me. And I can understand why you're an alcoholic, but why am I an alcoholic? Because those things did not happen to me. And it wasn't until I started to get into the work of the 12 steps and primarily the inventory steps that I began to understand why I felt the way I felt. And that was that no matter how hard my parents tried to instill in me that self-esteem, that they would want me to have security and feel safe, no matter how much they tried to give that to me, they didn't have that themselves. And what it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we cannot transmit that which we do not have. And they could not give to me what I didn't have, what they didn't have. So what happened was, is I grew up feeling, I had alcoholism. I needed a drink a long time before I took a drink. And that's why I love the way Clancy describes the disease of alcoholism. Because I'm the same way. I'm the kind of person that when I'm not drinking is when things get bad. I need to drink in order to just feel right. And I love it when Clancy says that we're people who have to be treated special just to feel average. And if we're not treated special, then we feel rejected. And, you know, I'm a Texan, so in Texas, maybe in Florida you do too, in Texas we puff up. Y'all puff up? We puff up. And what happens is that it is your responsibility to find out what's wrong with me. I don't have to communicate it. You're supposed to know. And then if you don't make me happy, then you don't love me. Now, you talk about arrogance, yet I felt this small. So what happens is that it, you know, you can go either side of the spectrum. I mean, whether you're really, really arrogant or you just really feel so sorry for yourself, it's still all about me. And what I love about Dottie is Dottie says, you know, Polly, it's not necessary you think well of yourself. It's just you think only of yourself. So what I do is I think about me a lot, you know, and I mean, it may not be good, but it was always fear. And it was always me thinking about me. And it was, you know, you could go and you can do the self-esteem, the security. You can just go right down and start looking at the fears. I'm never going to be enough. I got married when I was 18 years old. I married an Air Force officer. And I, you know, I'm looking at this uniform and it looks great. It looks like a knight in shining armor to me. But, you know, by the time I got to Mather Air Force Base in Sacramento, California, at the ripe old age of 18, I had a lot to learn. And I got an invitation from the base commander's wife, and it said that I was to attend this coffee. And I am not educated. I do not have a college education. And I've always been intimidated about that. So there's another fear. I'm always intimidated. You're always better than me. But the other thing is I'm a slothing alcoholic. Because you see, I want those letters after my name, but I don't want to go to school. You know, I want the title without the work. And I still don't have a college education. Thank God I have a little, you know, have had some education along the way, even though it's not college education. But at any rate, I was really, really intimidated. And I was so overwhelmed with feelings of inadequacy because I'm going to have to go to this coffee where all these other women are. And these other women are going to be sophisticated, they're going to be educated, and they're going to be so much better than me. Now, I want you to know, if you can see all this low self-worth and low self-esteem, the only person I've ever been thinking about through this whole thing is me. And that, you know, I'm less than them. But I had this fear that I would never, ever measure up, no matter what I did. Then this base commander's wife begins to talk to us little second lieutenant's wives, and she began to tell us what we were going to have to do to enhance our husband's career. We were going to have the right dinner parties. We were going to attend the right dinner parties. We were going to attend the right functions. We were going to dress appropriately. We're going to wear the right length gloves. All of this stuff was going on, and I was terrified. I thought, there is no way I can measure up to this. Driven by 100 forms of fear. And I didn't think that I could fulfill what I was supposed to do. I had not yet taken a drink of alcohol. Yet I had all this stuff going on for all those many years. Because, you see, I was raised in a religion that said, thou shalt not drink. And so that God, I just knew if I drank, because I had this really punishing God when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that, you know, somehow or another he'd strike me dead, even though I knew that all of these people that I was meeting drank, and they were good people. So, I mean, it was just, you know, that thing that we get into, which is that walking contradiction and that confusion. And at any rate, I went to a luncheon a week or so later, and I took a drink of alcohol. And, all I know is that the first time I took a drink of alcohol, for the first time in my life, I was only 18, but for the first time, I could breathe. I could just breathe. And when Clancy was doing that thing last night with the drink, I'm telling you, I felt it, because that's the way I felt. I felt like, because I always had, I don't know, it seems like all my stuff always, you know, fear and anxiousness, and I mean, it just all kind of is in my body. I just feel it. You know, it's when your chest's all tight and your stomach's all knotted and your temples are beating and all that stuff. It just seems to manifest itself in my body. And I took a drink of alcohol, and I could breathe. So what I could see was that alcohol would help me with that fear. And I get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you tell me I got to do these inventories, and you tell me I've got to be free of these fears. These fears are what's paralyzing me. These fears are what's keeping me in this tightness. And it says, but didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? So what I was going to have to do was find a way to see how my fears were keeping me a prisoner. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. And I love what Scott says. We listed our fears. We put them down. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we ask ourselves why we had them. Okay, why am I afraid? Now, sometimes, and you can do this however you want to, but I'll just tell you how I do it. And I loved what Scott did, because he showed you the spiral notebook. I do it a little different when I'm doing an inventory. And I guess it's because I just allow women to be a little more wordy. But when I say list, you know, when you make a list, I just have somebody in the four columns, I just have them put a name on each page, you know. So sometimes you got a little bit to write, sometimes you got a lot to write. But at any rate, but we listed our fears. And what I like to do with that is list our fears and then just do... Michael asked me today, she says, are you going to have a board? Because I'm a board user. Those of you who've ever seen me do the steps know I use a flip chart, you know, to do a diagram. I'm a visual person, so I do everything visually. But just visualize a piece of paper with, if you want to, a lot of lines on it. And if you want to start with, I'm afraid nobody will like me. And then it's, and I'm afraid, then, okay, what's that about? I'm afraid nobody will like me. I'm afraid that I am inadequate. I'm afraid of responsibility. What I want to do is get down to what I'm really afraid of. And sometimes what I have to do is I have to keep breaking that fear down until I get down to a word. And what I'm usually afraid of, the biggest one, or for me, is I'm afraid of dying. I'm afraid there's no God. And I'm afraid of the unknown. I don't know what's out there. I don't know what's going to happen. So these fears control me. Even though I may be afraid of things that look like I'm afraid of flying. Well, why am I afraid of flying? I'm afraid of crashing. Why am I afraid of crashing? I'm afraid of dying. Why am I afraid of dying? I'm afraid there's no God. And just try to get the fear broke down and get the layers off. And sometimes we can't do it all at once. Sometimes we don't know all at once. But we do the best we can. That's what the inventory keeps telling us to do, is that we do the best we can. And what we're going to do is now we're going to begin to really trust in God to show us these fears. And doing what Scott said, it takes a lot of prayer. Now, sometimes when people are at the fourth step, they don't have a lot of God in their lives yet. So, because we're just now at the inventory steps. So if you're at the inventory and you don't have a lot of God in your life right now, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, because I love what Clancy said and I love what Scott says. Trust your sponsor. Just do what they say. Just do it. Just do it anyway. Just what happens is a lot of times people, you hear this in AA, you hear it everywhere, maybe not just in AA, but I don't believe it. They say you can't have fear and faith at the same time. I don't believe that. What I believe is I have fear, and I take an action of faith to get me to walk through the fear. So what happens is I have these fears. The sponsor says, is what happened with me, because the God of my understanding, when I start working this four step, is going to strike me dead. That's the kind of God I have. I was terrified of God. I truly believe that all God wanted to do was kill me. I mean, I'd heard that. You're born a sinner. You're going to burn in hell. And, I mean, you know, it's like, and I mean, I heard it loud and clear. Them preachers were pounding that podium and yelling into the congregation, scaring the bejesus out of me. You know, I just kept wondering when I was a little girl, how did I get so bad so soon? You know, I just didn't get it. But I needed to hang on to somebody else's God. And what I love, my first AA sponsor was a man. He had been a Monsignor priest, and he had left the priesthood to marry a Taiwanian woman. Now, Frank, he 12-stepped me out of a dirty old motel in Euless, Texas, and he brought me into a treatment center. Frank had done beautiful, and he was just my hero. He was my hero. Now, nowhere in this book do I see where it says men sponsor men and women sponsor women. I believe it's a God deal. It's a God deal. What happens is I've not been asked to sponsor men, so I don't, but I just sponsor women. But my husband sponsors a woman, and I was sponsored by a man. And I needed, God gave me exactly what I needed. Because Frank, he just looked at me and I believed him. And he says, Polly, you just believe that I believe and you can use my God. And that's what took me through this inventory process. Because one of the things that I had to deal with in the resentment inventory was so much of how I could just see how I had harmed so many people and resented them at the same time. So I needed a lot of Frank's God. I needed a lot. And this wasn't Frank Honeycutt. This was another Frank in Texas that Frank Honeycutt sponsored. So I had the help of this man to let me borrow his God to help me with these fears so I could begin to face these fears. And we got them on paper and we looked at them. And we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is in this way of strength, the verdict through the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him, and here is the prayer for the fear inventory. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us to do. At once, we commence. We don't outgrow fear. We commence to outgrow fear. And that's what I've been doing. I've been commencing for 31 years. And a lot of the fears that I had, I don't have anymore. But I can assure you, I mean, I don't get up here behind this podium without fear. I would love to be able to get up here without fear. But I am always full of fear when I'm walking up here. I'm shaking. I feel, you know, I have those feelings of overwhelming inadequacy. I have those very fears that I had 31 years ago when I came here. The difference is today is that I ask God to give me the courage to do it anyway, to just do it anyway. And I'll be so glad when the day comes when I don't get up here and have that fear, that I can get behind this podium and it's going to, you know, and just relax and, hi, y'all. And I can't wait for that. But for me, I have to stay in the work because I'm still dealing with fear. So I keep exercising faith by asking God to help me and do it anyway. So, okay. What time does this session end? 12? 12? Does this session end at 12? Yeah, okay. Well, now I got... Okay, you guys. Everybody's been teasing me. We're ready for sex?
Yeah.
Woo! So, all right. The book says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. So... But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes. Perhaps one set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of pre-creation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that the most of our troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. We can all thank Freud for that. They think we do not have enough of it, or if it's not the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. So, we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about it? Okay, I'm here to tell you that I don't see anywhere in this book that it says stay out of a relationship for the first year.
Yay.
I am a person... I loved Ellen Aldridge. Ellen Aldridge was an absolutely beautiful woman in Long Beach. And she absolutely nabbed Red when he had about 30 minutes of sobriety. And although Red was her eighth husband, she stayed married to him until the day he died, which was over 30 years. So who's to say? Okay, who's to say what's going to work and what isn't going to work? I don't know. I am not the arbitrator of anybody's sex conduct. Now, when somebody comes to me and they're talking about relationship, they need a relationship, I'm going to tell them, you know, a lot of people drink over a broken heart. And you may get in this relationship and you're going to have a broken heart. And so it might be a little, you know, think about it. But I can tell you right now that I am just the kind of person that if somebody would have told me not to get in a relationship for the first year of sobriety, I would have just done it anyway. And I need to let you know that when I did this sex inventory, I did the first one. Wasn't that bad the first time because I had not had a lot of sexual misconduct during drinking. I'm just not that kind of alcoholic. You know, I've often wondered, why on earth do I ever get to talk in AA meetings? Because my drunkalogue is so boring. You know, I want to be like Michael. I want to be having an affair with a one-legged preacher. You know, I want to be doing something fun. And I was never doing that. I mean, my drinking was just so boring. And because all I did was lay on my sofa and drink alcohol and take tranquilizers and sleeping pills. And I tell you, if you take tranquilizers and sleeping pills and drink alcohol, you're not an active alcoholic. And there's just not much going on. So when I got sober, and I was a very dutiful military wife. I never had headaches or such as that because I was told a long time ago, very early on, by this base commander's wife that my husband was out fighting wars, and when he came home, he needed to be unstressed, and most men get de-stressed, if that's such a word, or unstressed, I don't even know, by sexual activity. And that was my job as a wife. So I never did, you know, the headache thing or any, you know, I might lay there and say, oh God, please let it be over, but I didn't do any of the other stuff, you know. Now, that, you know, also with the sex inventory, we're going to get onto the inventory of harms done. So that might have been a harms done, you know, because he probably knew that. And so there wasn't that much, except that by the time I did this inventory, I had been sober, had been drinking, gone to treatment, drinking, gone to treatment, drinking, gone to treatment. Because I'm one of these people that's been to treatment 3 times. And the last time they decided to keep me for a long time. And what happened in my first treatment is that I don't know about a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got married at 18. I started drinking at 18. I sobered up at 36, and I was in a treatment center, and I sobered up. And I can tell you this. My libido had been asleep for 18 years. And when I got sober, I looked around. I was one woman in this, and it was a county detox. This was not a super nice place to get sober. And I was one woman in there with 11 men. And I tell you, these weren't 11 prosperous men. And believe me, I had the arrogance. I'm an officer's wife. Don't you know who I am? But what happened was, is these 11 men started to look really good. Because the libido had come back on, and especially one looked really good. So when I left that treatment center, and I'm married, you know, I mean, I'm married. I left that treatment center with one of the men in the treatment center. You know, Jenner House romance, you know, where sick falls in love with sick. You walk off into happy destiny. We walked into happy destiny for 58 days. And then I'm brought back into this treatment center because I've been beaten up and numerous other things. I'm brought back into this treatment center. And that's when I loved it, when I heard Clancy's tape, Alcoholism, a Disease of Perception. Because on that tape, he talks about the disease of alcoholism. And my problem is sobriety. I can't live sober. I can't live with me sober. I'm going to destroy myself sober. And I couldn't live sober. So what I ended up doing was spending 7 days in that detox and then tried to take my life. I knew that there was no way I could live sober. I couldn't live having an affair with that man, being married, all of this stuff. So Sex was starting sober and drinking to hurt my life. So when I took my first sexual inventory about harms done sexually, I talked about how I had hurt my husband, how I had belittled him sexually, and how I had made it seem like, you know, something I had to do. It wasn't a loving act. And how I had had an affair with this man. Now, you would think that maybe I would have got it because it made me feel so bad. But for the next 3 years, my sexual inventory would grow and grow and grow. Because what happened is I got sober and I was everything I never, ever wanted to be. And that was, I was married, having numerous affairs and AA with other men, married. I self-destructed. I totally self-destructed through relationships and sex the first 3 years of my sobriety. That is something I'm so ashamed of. And a lot of times I keep thinking, you know, I don't think there's any mistakes in God's world. And I have many times been able to share that with other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can go do this if you want to, but let me tell you my experience. And what I always try to do is never share anything that's not my experience. Because there are a lot of people who've been molested and have had some tragic things happen as children that it's not my experience. So when I'm working with somebody, fortunately I sponsor enough people that I have women who it's their experience. But I can tell you, having affairs sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is my experience. It's my experience. And my sexual inventory at 3 years of sobriety was very long. And I am so grateful that I had a sponsor who was able to take me through that and show me the harms that I had done, because they were tremendous. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to just go, in the big book it said, we reviewed our own conduct. That doesn't mean I get into your conduct. What you do with your sexual conduct and how you behave is between you and God. Now, I will tell you, I have been known to get in a few men's faces if I know that, you know, they're going to just use and abuse one of my newcomers and tell them, I'd kindly appreciate it if you stay away from my girl. And, you know, I may say it a little stronger than that, and they're... So, and I mean, I've known several people that I have gone up to and say, you know, here comes my gorgeous little newcomer. She's just so cute. You can't ever see. And I know this guy. I know him. And I look at him and I very casually whisper in his ear, I'll break your neck if you touch me. So. And that's experience. I have had the experience. I was a newcomer. And I hold true responsibility for my own conduct. But I guarantee you that I didn't do this alone. Okay. So. Okay. We reviewed our sex conduct over the years. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? So the sex inventory is a little bit different, because the sex inventory is about people I've harmed. If you have had molestation and been harmed, raped yourself, and you have been hurt sexually, that goes on the resentment inventory. And the sex inventory is for the harms I've done. And I also list the harms I've done at the end of this inventory, even though they were not sexual. because I can tell you the biggest harms that I had were my parents, my husband, and my two children. And my sons, because of the disease of alcoholism, I had drugged my two children through the disease of alcoholism. And what I had done to them, my children were traumatized. My children were so affected by the disease of alcoholism. So one of the things I like to do with the women that I work with is I like to ask them some questions. And I usually go to the 12 and 12. And I just want to, the 12 and 12 and step 4 on page 50. And this is where I take them and ask these questions, because this is just a little bit more detail than the big book says. The big book just has selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, whom had we hurt, where had we justifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. And what I want to do is just kind of go a little bit more in detail. And so what I do is I go to page 50 and I say, here's some questions that you may want to ask yourself. When and how and just what instances did my selfish pursuit of sex relations damage other people and me? Because I will assure you, me doing what I did, having those affairs sober and AA, I did not just hurt those men. Believe me, I devastated myself. I devastated myself because I absolutely became a slut sober. What people were hurt and how badly? How about my husband? How about my children? How about the women I sponsored? Wasn't I a good example? Did I spoil my marriage and injure my children? Absolutely. My husband knew. My children knew. I didn't have the decency to be discreet. Did I jeopardize my standing in the community? What kind of example am I in Alcoholics Anonymous if I am behaving in this way? Just how did I react to these situations at the time? Same as I did drinking. I'm not hurting anybody. My husband and I are estranged anyway. Acting like it didn't affect my children. Selfish, self-centered. Everything's about me and my pleasures and what I'm getting out of this. Did I burn with guilt that nothing could extinguish? Yeah, I burned with guilt. It's almost like another drink. Burning with guilt so bad, just go do it again. It's amazing. Or did I insist that I was the pursued and not the pursuer? Oh, yeah. Most of the time, oh, he's after me. Ha ha. Thus absolve myself. Because, you know, I hear this a lot in AA. Well, he asked me to marry him, or he asked me on a date, so, you know, I had to go. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. How have I reacted to frustration in sexual matters? What have I done? Have I screamed? One of the things I used to scream at my husband, sober. If you would have been a better husband, I wouldn't have done this. It's all about me. Hurtful, harmful. When denied, did I become vengeful or depressed? Did I take it out on other people? Absolutely. If there was rejection or coldness at home, did I use that as a reason for promiscuity? I can't get the word out. Yes. So at 3.5 years of sobriety, I took another inventory, another sex inventory. And I also took some resentment, fears, and sex. I did that again because at 3.5 years of sobriety, I had known Dave since I got sober. Dave and I had just been AA buds. He was not someone that I had had an affair with. Now, he had sponsored a lot of the men I'd had an affair with. So Dave knew more about me than he needed to know. So at 3.5 years of sobriety, Dave came to me and he said, "Polly, I'm in love with you, but you need to get something straight. I'm not going to have an affair with you. I want to marry you." And I'm here to tell you that something like that's not supposed to happen to people like me. And I am so grateful that Dave loved me in spite of everything he knew about me. And but he also had some boundaries of his own, and that was that he was not going to have an affair with me. And I'm so grateful because it's been of that kind of love. And I know that this is not AA and it's not AA-approved literature, but and I'm not Buddhist, but I like to read a bunch of stuff that is and of other things. And the Bhagavad Gita says, if to love another person totally, we get to see the eyes of God. And I believe that. And that's what Dave has done for me. He has been that instrument that began to heal me. Because you see, when I got down to it, it was all about fear. The reason I did what I did was because I was just certain that nobody would ever love me. I was certain of it. Nobody would ever want to love somebody like me. And Dave did that. And Dave and I have had this beautiful relationship. And I want you to know that because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of the inventories and because of a loving God, I have been a faithful wife for 27 years. And I'm here to tell you, for me, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. And I don't know about any of you, but I know that there are women in this room whose self-worth is so low that we will sell our soul in order to be loved. We will sell our soul. And I know that I did that. I would sell my soul just so you would love me. And today I don't have to do that. And because of that healing, I have been able to make amends to my sons because I harmed them terribly. I harmed my ex-husband terribly. My ex-husband died 8 years ago. And I want you to know that he and I, because of this program and all the stuff that went down in our lives, we were friends. And he ended up remarrying, and I ended up remarrying. And in fact, his wife, when we lived in Southern California, his widow would come visit my son and daughter-in-law who live in Southern California, and she would stay with Dave and I. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When that kind of hurt can go down and we can have this kind of healing, it is absolutely amazing. And all I can do is just encourage you with all my heart, encourage you to pick up these inventories and do them. Because as much shame, and I was so full of shame, and I didn't think that I could sit down and do this inventory and tell the truth. But because of that, I know that one of the things that's important for me, and my husband says it all the time, he says that what it's all about is I can't do anything you can't watch. Not that you'd want to watch it, but I can't do anything you can't watch. And that's my barometer. You know, because I need today to live my life out loud. I need to live my life out loud. And I need to be an open book, because not that you care to know what my life is about, but if I don't live my life out loud, I'm the one who will pay the price. I am so grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful to the recovery I have. I love my life. I am so grateful for the life I have today. And I thank you so much for giving it to me.